Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 119 of Registry Matters.
Larry, how are you? I'm talking to you from inside of a gas mask. Are you okay?
I couldn't resist.
Oh, you sound fantastic.
Yes, that's because I have one of those N95 masks. I bought it years ago as I was prepping. I've got 7 years of canned food in my cupboards. I've got a bathtub full of water for when they shut off the power. Shut off the water. I've got backup generators. I've got candles, batteries. I got everything. I'm ready to be a prepper.
Well, I tell you, I was feeling pretty good about our state in terms of this. We're going to talk about the virus a lot more later, but we didn't have any cases until just a few days ago. And now they've tested and diagnosed and confirmed 10 cases. But we went from having plenty of everything in the stores to the stores being emptier than I've ever seen in my entire life. And I don't understand it, because it's like, really, folks, this is, at this point in time, this hasn't reached anywhere near the level of where we've had infectious diseases spreading in the past, but yet the people are just wiping the stores out completely.
And you're at any minimum, Larry, you are an above average intelligence person, and by far you're smarter than that. And you are great at explaining things and understanding, I think, better than most people. I can't for the life of me understand the toilet paper thing. I just don't, like, I don't know how much paper you need if there's an epidemic that you couldn't move to napkins and or paper towels or baby wipes if things became dire. I don't understand why. I was at Sam's yesterday and I saw, like, every buggy I saw coming out of the thing had 400 rolls of toilet paper. They had 17 gallons of water and they all had Lysol wipes. And out of that, the Lysol wipes are the only one that I actually understand.
For you listeners who are not in the southern United States, the buggies is a colloquialism for the shopping cart that you would be pushing around the store.
My bad. So,
for our international and global audience that we have. But I don't understand it either, because, and I got admonished by one of our patrons already, because I said, well, just in the normal course of living, you would think that a normal household would have a supply of tissue, because you get the best economic value by buying multi-roll packs, which means if you bought a 12 or 16 or 18 or these different combinations of rolls, depending on the brand, that unless you're on the verge of running out, you would have enough to last you a week or two. And for us to be continuously without tissue for more than a week or two would be bizarre, because I can't imagine that anything would drive us to that point. That's a product that's largely made in the U.S. as far as I know. And I know we have, to my surprise, we actually have a plant here in Albuquerque that I didn't know anything about, but it made the news last night because they are selling cases of 96 rolls for $35. And they had lines that you wouldn't believe, because they're not set up for a retail customer. They provide this to as a wholesale operation, but they're willing to sell to the public, and people were lining up and buying 96 rolls. Now, I don't know much, but 96 rolls, regardless of the tissue count on the 96 rolls, that's going to last for a little while in almost any size household, but particularly a household of four or less. 96 rolls is going to last you quite some time. I would venture to guess that'd be a year's supply for a household of four. If you could go through more than 96 rolls in a year, I'd be very surprised.
Maybe, let's see, four, two, maybe, anyway, whatever. I didn't want to, like, yeah. Why? Why? Anyway, we can dig into that. I just don't understand the toilet paper. I just don't.
Well, it's an irrational response to emotion has set in. This is kind of like the stock market's gyrations of significant move. Do you believe that when you take a third of the value, which we've lost as of before the bounce on Friday, we lost close to a third of the value. Do you believe that all the enterprise value of the basket of all the stocks that are listed and traded on Wall Street, do you think they have shrunk by one third in a matter of less than 2 weeks? Of course not.
No, of course not. And I just have always understood that to be almost like the emotional barometer of the United States, or at least of the companies listed, more so than it's actually their value. Community.
It's the emotion of the investors, and once the slide starts, that's what we're having here with these hoarding of purchasing. The scarcity is causing people to react irrationally, because when they see the TV of lines, they figure, well, I should be in this line too. And when they see the TV pictures of the shelves, I mean, how often do you, an average person, before this happened, the average person, how often did you see metal shelving when you're in a grocery store?
No,
very rare.
And I just uploaded a picture into chat. I went to the Kroger just a couple of days ago, and it's a big Kroger. It's like one of the super ones that has clothing and all that other crap, and just bare shelves. I just uploaded it into chat because I was just like, I know I'm not going to be able to buy any here, but I just want to check and see. And there it was.
The only time you see what you're seeing right now is in a store that's closing. When you eliminate the retail, if you close a large store. The way I've seen it done, and we've actually, when I was in the business, closed a few. You shrink the store, and you close off parts of the store, and you continue to merchandise it to a smaller and smaller area. That way, it doesn't look as empty. And then but for what you're seeing in these stores right now, they're not closing, so they're not gonna cordon off parts of the store for this. But you just have these empty gaps of the paper aisle, the cereal aisles, and the sanitary stuff. And actually, I saw this cereal aisle coming back today. It was empty yesterday, but I was down, and apparently they got enough that they sprinkled some product, and the box cereals were back.
Larry, let's move on before we'll ruin the whole coronavirus section. I got a great little sound clip to play for that one, too. So our first article comes from Courthouse News. Supreme Court takes up teens' life without parole case. I just have one thing to actually say, Larry. If you don't want to do the time, don't do the crime. Right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we should just nuke them, and doesn't matter if they're 8 years old. I don't know. How old was the kid that he was 15 years old when he committed this crime? He killed his grandfather? That seems like he probably wanted to give him a switch or something.
Well, and there's been Supreme Court rulings, and we've heard Scalia talk in opposition to these rulings where that they've held that juveniles should not be subjected to life imprisonment, should not be subjected to the death penalty. And he vehemently disagrees with that. But in this case, after the Supreme Court ruled that life without parole could not just be arbitrarily imposed, that it had to be for a person who was incorrigible, or should be, that's our argument, that it should be for a person incorrigible. This judge resentenced him after he was entitled to a new sentencing, and the judge imposed the same sentence, and now the Supreme Court's agreed to determine if there should be a standard of the person being incorrigible before they can be given life without parole. And that's a nuanced argument that they're putting forth, that should be a standard. But Scalia would tell you that if that's the standard that the state of Alabama citizens want, they can insert that into their statutory scheme, that the life in prison is only available for a juvenile who's been determined to be incorrigible. Don't come to us and ask us to invent this requirement. It's not in the statute. That would be his position. So it's going to be interesting with the more conservative leading of the court, if they're going to be able to find five votes to come to that conclusion, if they're going to do the legislating from the bench.
And let me channel my inner Scalia then, and you help, you grade me as the teacher would. So according to, as I understand how Scalia would say it, if Mississippi didn't want this individual sentenced to life without parole, if they didn't want him sentenced to life without parole so that he would get parole, then Mississippi would have created a law saying that you can't take a juvenile, as you would say, juvenile, and sentence him to life without parole. Now he's asking that the Supreme Court step in and say, because he was juvenile, because he wasn't well developed, all that stuff, that the black robe should step in and say, no, Mississippi, you can't do that. And Scalia wouldn't be in favor of that.
Scalia would not be in favor of that because he believes in the gift of the Mississippi voters and their intelligence, and that they would be able, if they want to spare that penalty, except for the most heinous crimes, they can spell that out, and they can spell out this new theory of incorrigible. And if they wanted that, they would have said that. And he believes to assume that they weren't capable of knowing what they wanted when they enacted that penalty scheme and made it available is an insult and an improper role for the courts. And if you believe in that philosophy, that I mean, it's a very viable. I tell people Scalia is very well reasoned in what his arguments that if you believe in the state's rights and the intelligence of the Mississippi voters, they knew what they enacted.
One piece of this, Larry, that I do still struggle with is that we have a very unengaged electorate. Even as far back as I know of, we would only have something of like a third of the people vote in the big elections. Forget the off-year elections. Forget any of the local city council things that'll happen like mid-year or something like that. Just a small fraction of the people even vote that give a crap about it. So now you're not being represented by the people. You're being represented by some people.
Well, I mean, arguably, the people who do choose to participate are probably more engaged than the ones who don't.
True.
I wish that people took the time, and maybe since we're not having a professional sports, people can rechannel some of their time to that they would be watching the hoops and the March Madness and the all the different things, NASCAR and what have you. Maybe they can actually spend some of that time becoming a more informed person. But if we had 75% participation, does that magically make the people going to be informed just because they vote? Or where do we get the evidence that having more people vote would mean that those people would be more informed?
And on the heels of that other article, another one that comes from the Georgia Recorder, where the Georgia House Committee Monday recommended raising the age a teenager can be charged as an adult from 17 to 18. This would be this would be the inverse of what happened in Mississippi, where the person was 15 and got sentenced to life without parole. I'm assuming he then got charged as an adult in that condition. So here in Georgia, they're changing it from 17 to 18 instead of what it was in Mississippi of being 15. Am I even characterizing that close to accurate?
Yes, the de facto in Georgia, and it was all that when I was there, that was the way it was 40 years ago. If you reach 17 for purposes of criminality, that was an adult. And now they're looking at changing that, but there's a significant amount of opposition cropping up because of the cost. And I pulled the fiscal impact report. They call it the fiscal note, and Georgia Assembly, but there's a four-page report explaining to why this is going to adversely affect the state budget. Because when you put people in the juvenile system, there's a lot of checks and balances and rehabilitation intent, and there's social work, and there's all these things that they don't do in the adult system that are going to cost money. And if they move them out of the adult prisons, and depending on how many people actually end up in a correctional setting, you're going to need space that they presently don't have. So they're going to have to build facilities. So then the number of people, when you remove people from an overpopulated adult system, which Georgia is one of the top incarceration states, that doesn't magically translate to that facility closing down. If you take 20 juveniles out of this one and 15 out of that one, all you do is just alleviate a little bit of the stress in the system.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't magically mean that Georgia's going to be able to close some of the adults and then that it closed down the adult system prisons and say, oh, well, that money just magically moves over to juvenile services. So there's opposition to this because of the cost.
But couldn't we find study after study after study that if we intervene earlier and keep them out of the adult system, that those kids would be less likely to come back in the system later and have a better chance of becoming productive citizens, et cetera?
That has entered into the debate, and that's being considered, and that's a part of the discussion. That has not gone unnoticed. But still, that doesn't alleviate the money that we need now.
Yeah, and going back to the 30 people that you pulled out of the system, that just makes it so that the county jail can put 30 people into the beds that they just relieved from the juveniles.
Or the state prison that if you went into Georgia right now and you could magically wave a wand and find everyone who was charged as a 17-year-old and you could somehow extract those, that would not free up enough, according to this fiscal note, that would not free up enough space to have any tangible impact on the adult corrections system. So you've got all these new costs coming online. And that's a struggle I fight with people all the time when they say, in the long run, we're going to save money. But we're not in the long run. We have a budget to balance for this year. And so those lawmakers who convene in Annapolis or Atlanta or Montgomery or wherever they are, they're trying to balance this year's budget.
How does a conversation occur to take into account something that is 5 or 10 or 20 years out? How does that conversation occur?
Well, the way it's occurring right now, it's coming in long term. We're going to save some money, but in the meantime, I need revenue to balance this budget.
Sure.
And since we can't increase taxes, that's a mortal sin to do that. We're going to need new revenue that's going to come from somewhere, or we're going to have to reduce outlays to some other, as far as everybody's concerned, who we're going to take the money from. If you ask for a show of hands of all the things the state of Georgia does, and who would like to step up and say they would be willing to have a little bit less money, there won't be any hands go up.
Got it.
So that therein lies the problem of trying to, it's the problem that the states largely face, because they have to balance their budgets. Most states, at least by appearances, operate under a balanced budget. Now, at the federal level, we get to operate as a deficit spend, and apparently in perpetuity, because in my life, I've been hearing that we're going to reach this magic day of reckoning, and that we won't be able to borrow anymore. And I've heard it since I was quite young. And now I've gotten to be a little bit older, and I'm still hearing it. And we're running massive deficits and talking about actually ballooning the deficit further, but more. They're talking about relieving the payroll tax, which is the Social Security assessment. And I think that the figure I heard that's about a $60 billion, between $50 and $60 billion a month in revenue that would be foregone if they completely eliminate that for the remainder of this year. Where do we get the $50 or $60 billion monthly gap that's going to create on the revenue side of the ledger? Where do we plug that? How do we plug that?
Won't the windfall of the increased economic activity, won't that just offset everything?
Well, I think we've seen that enough times to know it doesn't happen.
I am poking the bear, Larry.
They've been making that argument since the days of Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover, which is approaching 100 years. They've been saying that, and it never has done the magic thing. So if you forego $50 billion of revenue, you are correct. There would be people, since these are wage earners that are paying this, to pay Social Security taxes. You have to have a job, and you have to be earning $137,000 a year or less. So, yes, those people, by and large, would consume more. There would be some activity that would be generated. But would it plug that gap? And even if it did plug the gap, which I don't believe it would, but it wouldn't be going into the Social Security Trust Fund. Mm-hmm. The revenue that would be generated would be going to other revenue streams. But Social Security Trust Fund, that's a dedicated revenue stream that comes from the assessment out of your paycheck of a combined rate of 7.65, and then another 7.65 comes from the employer.
Yep. The other part of that that's actually kind of interesting, though, is it's just on that, take a quick little detours. Maybe if it's enough money that comes back in your pocket, that resolves the demand side, that you have the money to do it. But that doesn't resolve the supply side. You still can't get toilet paper, even if you have an extra 6.5% in your paycheck. You still can't get it.
I don't believe that this is going to be a long-term crisis on toilet paper. First of all, I don't think that having additional toilet paper actually would increase consumption much. And so I think the consumption is going to be largely a factor of how many people we have, and unless the United States all of a sudden doubles its population. So I think that the supply chains are going to catch up, because as the manufacturer in Albuquerque said, they said, we've got plenty. We can supply this whole city with tissue. So I just don't think that's going to be a long-term problem. But the panic is there because you can't find it.
Yes. Which then spars more panic, because, like, oh my God, I'm down to 3 rolls. I may as well go get another bundle. And man, we've already detoured back to toilet paper.
You people are something else.
It's unbelievable. But let's move quickly over to an article. I keep hearing from people about this one. And this was written by a friend of mine named Fred. It's over on the NARSAL website. And it is Michigan State Police turning away pre-2011 registrants. I keep hearing that people are going in to do their annual registration stuff, and the police are saying, nope, don't have to do it. Have a nice day. You have to think that you would go in there and like, well, now what am I supposed to do? Yes, they're not having me register now. Are they going to reenact some law that's going to pull me back in? How do I know when that happens? If you don't register, isn't the law still on the books? I think So the police turning you away is one thing, but you're still not necessarily in compliance. This has got to be a nightmare for people in Michigan to navigate.
Well, I wouldn't view it as much of a nightmare, but I tend to analyze things differently than the person. If the statute has been declared unconstitutional as applied to this, and we talked about it on the conference call the other night, these pre-2011 people, it's been declared unconstitutional. It has not been enjoined from enforcement. The injunction hasn't taken effect. It actually has been, the injunction has been issued, but yet to go into effect. It would be the strangest prosecutorial setup that would ever exist in the history of humanity. And I know this is the craziest prosecutions, but for a prosecutor to come in and the defense attorney says, okay, you brought a charge, which I don't see him doing, and I'm going to say that the statute had been ruled unconstitutional, an injunction had been issued, and the law enforcement told them not to come. Now, do you still want to proceed with this prosecution? I would be very surprised if you could find an insane prosecutor that would go forward like that.
That sounds like it's same prosecutor that you would find that if you were 10 minutes over your 48-hour, one-week registration, being in a different state, that they'd be like, just go register. Don't bother with this. So they would hit you, maybe not kid gloves, even less than. They would just be like, okay, go do your stuff because you actually have to go do your stuff.
Well, I don't think they're going to do anything until the matters are resolved in terms of whether the legislature is going to create a new registry. I believe the legislature will create a new registration obligation for all those people. I hope I'm completely wrong and that they don't. But I don't see them letting thousands of people just evaporate into oblivion and saying, well, we tried, we gave up. Because your most recent iteration of registration is unconstitutional, that doesn't mean every iteration is unconstitutional. In fact, to the contrary, every iteration prior to where we are now had been held to be constitutional. So logically, if you can't think of anything else, you would say, okay, well, let's reenact the last constitutional version. So I think that if they were to do that, which is I expect they'll do something in the way of trying to re-register these people, there would be notice go out. I would think there'd be public service announcements, and I think there'd be letters from law enforcement saying the new law has been enacted as of whatever day it's effective. You have an obligation to register. Come in. That's what I think would happen. I don't think there'd be an I got you moment. Oh, well, you didn't register during the time that it was declared unconstitutional while the injunction was in force, and the law took effect on July 1st of 2020, and here it is July 2nd, and we got you. I don't see that happening.
Let me just, I don't remember when it was in our history, but it was relatively early in our podcast history, so maybe it's around episode 20 or something like that. We covered an article where it was about reciprocity laws with gun ownership and traveling across state lines from one jurisdiction into another. And that the gun owner, the politicians were like, well, we want to make sure that our gun owners, when they end up violating this law because they're in a new jurisdiction, that they don't get trapped into something. So we want to notify them. And at the same time, we paired it exactly up with an article that, well, we're going to change the law on the registrants and we're going to say, FYP, you guys have to figure out, you follow the law. Almost as if to trip them up, but also on the other side for the gun owners to make it so that they don't get tripped up. I say that just to provide contrast that maybe in Michigan they wouldn't do that and say, hey, look, you know, you are going to be required to register, so make sure you don't miss your date.
Well, right now they're telling people that they don't have to register because if they fit in this pre-2011 group, but if they restore that obligation to register, I don't think they're going to play out got you. I think they're going to notify people by public service announcements and by letters that the legislature has created and the governor has signed a new obligation and you need to get in here and register. That's what I think they'll do. I don't think they're going to do it. I got you now. Now, if a year and a half goes by,
right,
and they've sent out two letters and you haven't come in and they happen to find you, I think that would change the equation.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be one of those spontaneous things where they're sitting around with a stopwatch waiting to say, I got you.
And I don't remember the specifics behind collecting evidence behind trying to establish a case with something else that we were talking about. But in the article, it says the Michigan ACLU is advising registrants to try and register anyway. And if refused, try to get something in writing that says that they do not need to register at this time, but you know, something that says, hey, I came and you guys said no. And so here's some evidence and don't take that home and shred it, something like that.
Well, I think the memo that the state police distributed, it would be sufficient. If I were licensed to practice law and someone got charged in Michigan during this temporary period where we have lack of clarity, I would feel quite confident and comfortable going forward with that memorandum from the state police, which is the, by all practical purposes, they're not the chief law enforcement, but they are the best funded. They are the premier agency in the state of Michigan, and they are the guiding agency in terms of registration, in terms of providing know-how, technical expertise, and oversight to the counties and the local. So if I had that memo and someone got charged with violating the registry of Michigan, I would be in hog heaven. So, I mean, it would be it on the list of my priorities of things that it would worry me and keep me awake at night. This wouldn't be one of them.
Very well. Moving over to a channel we've covered, I think, one of this person's videos once before. It's a channel named Common Sense Laws. And a new video was released recently, and I've got a clip to play from it. And it's talking about his experience with moving into Germany. And then the story goes on to like a friend of like more than just an acquaintance, but not like, hey, this is my chummy chum best friend. And firsthand, secondhand, thirdhand, you know, it's not like we can document and prove what he's saying, but, and you know, and do you want to give give a disclaimer on the information in this video before we get too far?
Sure. I would say that this is an individual who has opined that the nation of Germany, the Federal Republic of Germany, is not interested in a conviction older than 10 years. Therefore, come one, come all. We have not researched that. So this is his personal opinion. It's not us telling you that that is the way it is.
It's also not us saying he's lying either.
Nope. We're just saying that we're simply providing this to our listeners to convey three individuals' experience in Germany.
All right, it's a two-minute clip. Here we go.
They also asked him when his sex offense occurred. They never asked him a single detail about the offense. They only cared when did it occur. And he said, well, it was March 2000, so, you know, 20 years ago. And at that, both officers seemed very surprised. 20 years, okay. And he also added that he had done 7 years in prison, so he had finished his prison sentence in 2007. So again, you're talking a stretch of 13 years up until this point. So the officers, the lead officer, the main officer who was doing most of the talking, said then that, all right, I need to go write a report, and I'm going to go talk to my supervisor, and we'll make a decision as to whether or not we're going to let you into Germany. The officer leaves. So our guy stays in the interview room for about 20 minutes, conversing, you know, comfortably with this other officer. And I'd like to mention here that our guy told me that these officers were never anything but professional and courteous. There was never any aggression. There was never any yelling or demeaning talk, nothing like that. They never strip searched him, nothing like that. That it was rather comfortable interview. So 20 minutes later, this main officer, the lead officer, comes back and he says, all right, you're free to go. So our guy asks, well, wait a minute, for clarification, what do you mean I'm free to go? And the officer said, no, you're free to go. Go, you get your luggage, go about your business, enjoy your stay in Germany. And specifically the officer told him, and I think this is a quote, the past is the past and you should be allowed to go on with your life. 20 years ago, we don't care. We're not interested. And that was it. The officer literally escorted him back into the terminal, showed him where to get his luggage. Our guy picked up his luggage, carried it out of the airport, got on a local train, went to the main train station, got out of the main train station, and went to his hotel, put his stuff away, and then kind of stood there on the sidewalk like, what the hell happened?
The main thing that I really wanted to get out of this is the officer saying, hey, this is more than 10 years. Why are we worried about this if it happened 10 years ago?
Well, the Europeans do tend to be a little more forgiving of people's mistakes as time passes, and they think some stuff has the right to be forgotten. But I don't know the specifics of where that line is in Germany. And I would like for people to be clear, we're not saying jump on the next plane to Germany, you'll be fine. We're saying that one of our listeners has provided this information from experience of three people, and it may or may not be helpful to you.
We also don't know anything about what any of these individuals' crimes were, if they were super low on the scale, or, you know, how far up the scale they actually went, but you know, for Germany to not care about any of it. So anyway, I'm super intrigued by him, just by the host of that channel, getting into Germany and, you know, staking down roots and all that, and making things work for himself. I'm super interested in how he progresses.
So are you considering such a move?
I wouldn't be opposed to it. Not at all. Not at all. I mean, my income, I'm on the internet anyway. I work from home, and I telecommute as it is. What does it matter whether I'm inside the same time zone, inside the same state, halfway across the country, or in another country?
So, do they have the internet in Germany?
I think so. I think it's made it over there. But okay. I do not speak any German. That would be the one challenge. But I think they're pretty fluent in the Englishes.
Well, an awful lot of Germans speak English, I've learned.
Yes, I believe that to be true. Well, speaking of the internet, Larry, there's an article that just was posted in the last day or two, and I just put in the show notes. So I hope you had a chance to at least take a gander at it. But the New York Civil Liberties Union argues blanket ban on internet access for sex offenders is unconstitutional. Here we go. Another challenge saying that they can't take away the internets from all of the peoples. And so I'm all in favor. I just, in today's world, it, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, yeah, okay, you didn't have to go to bkjobs.com to go apply at Burger King. But now there's nothing you can do without being on the internet to get a job, just about.
This is litigation that I think Narsal had our communications director, I think Sandy wrote something about this, but this is litigation that's destined to probably have success, because the developed body of case law is that you just can't do that. You can't just, I mean, look at Packingham. I mean, you just can't tell people to not be on the internet. And Packingham was more about social media, but it's an integral part of modern life. So it's just too broad, not narrowly tailored. So I haven't read the complaint. I don't know the specifics of it, but if this lawsuit is halfway well done, it has a good chance of success.
And this is another example of where the state is telling you can't do a thing that relates to a freedom of speech. Not that Facebook is restricting you, not that your local news station or cooking show is restricting you, that this is the state saying you can't go on the internet.
That is correct. And the dicta and the decision in Packingham was quite clear that it was about social media, but the internet is a fact of modern life. That's how you do everything nowadays. In fact, if you got your census form, how did it, you should have gotten it by now. Your census form tells you to do what? Go to the internet.
Oh, I don't know that I've actually received, I haven't at least seen it, and it's possible that I, you know, just glanced over it, but it's pretty well marked that it says it's the census on it, right?
Yes, they were supposed to be mass distributed starting on the 12th of March of this year, and okay. People are supposed to turn them in by April 1st. But it doesn't have a form for you to fill out and turn
really?
In.
Really? You got to go
it
fill
has,
out?
It has.
Oh, my God.
It has
seriously.
It has a code. So you would not, you'd have to violate federal law, because you're compelled by law, and they don't prosecute people for this law, to fill out the census. But you'd have to wait for an enumerator to come out. Or for, I don't know if the next step, but they'll send you a written form and ask you to fill it out. If the enumerator comes out and knocks the door with the handheld device. But you'd have to break federal law to comply with this law.
That almost seems like a slam dunk that it should be pretty widely accepted by pretty much everybody on all terms, that you have to use the internet if the government is going to send you the required, federally required census form, that you have to go use the interwebs to fill out.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. I think this is pretty much a slam dunk. Now, you can do a lot of things that are narrowly tailored, and that's the problem that the law enforcement community doesn't seem to understand. You could conceivably require Halloween signs if you narrowly tailored the signs to who they applied to and made sure that it wasn't a blanket requirement. The government can compel speech. What do you think we would do if we have to go into mass quarantines and people, we don't have enough quarantine facilities, and they tell people that your house is quarantined and nobody can come in? They would put up a sign that would say, do not cross this line, house under quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a compelled speak by the government.
But they narrowly could compel tailored you to speak that individual person.
Narrowly
that has,
tailored because yeah. you are contagious, and we're doing this only for public safety. And as soon as the crisis abates, this sign will come down. That would withstand all the scrutiny that the person could throw under it at it, because it and that's the problem with law enforcement. They don't understand a lot of these play toys you'd like to play with. You could actually play with them if you would narrowly tailor it. And maybe you need to come to me because I could actually tell you how to do this stuff so that they wouldn't be vulnerable to our constitutional challenges.
You're like Rudy Giuliani in constructing a travel ban.
So, but I don't support this. But if somebody's going to write a restriction, I would rather I be writing it than you. If you're determined to have a ban of some kind, I prefer to be the writer versus you.
Yeah, I would love for you to describe the thing that you did before. Again,
The House Bill 720 that's going to require potential Halloween signs in Georgia, and also going to reinstate GPS monitoring that was declared unconstitutional in Park v. State. If they're determined, and it sounds like they are, to have these bans, would you rather me write them or they write them? Because they're not going to be narrowly tailoring anything.
Yeah, they're going to say if you're male, you have to do it. I mean, they're going to paint with a very wide brush on who has to do it.
Well, they're going to probably say anybody who has a sex offense, or at very minimum, they're going to see what you would need to do on that. If you were going to have any chance of it withstanding constitutional scrutiny, would be you would narrowly tailor it to an offender who had engaged in an offense where the person would be at risk by having people knock at their door. Now, so you have to do some thinking, and I don't have that proposal ready at the tip of my tongue here, but you would have to look at offender types where that having proximity to someone visiting their door was a fact in the offense, a factor that you can tangibly point to and say, well, we don't want anybody knocking at this person's door because of their unique characteristics, not because they're a sex offender on the registry, but because of their unique characteristics. And then you might have a chance of getting out the gate on a constitutional challenge because you're narrowly tailoring it, and you would only apply the most minimal restriction possible for the briefest period possible for 4 hours on Halloween night, and the sign comes down. But they don't think like that. They think they can put them up for a week or 10 days, and they put them on everybody's yard, and they humiliate everybody rather than figuring out some justification that would tangibly relate to that person. And that's why they lose. And they're destined to continue losing, because law enforcement, there's one thing you can count on law enforcement. That is their DNA, is they're wired to push ahead with aggression and force. They don't calculate and think very often in terms of how to get to their goals. They think about, if you don't comply, I'll tase you more times.
Don't tase me, bro.
That's their thought process, rather than, if you don't comply, I would like to do some verbal jousting with you to see if you can comply, because I don't want to have to use any escalating tools. They don't think like that. You're going to comply because I'm the police. Play that little clip now.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
There it is. I do love that clip. That is the most. He so sounds drunk, too. He sounds drunk.
But that is so indicative of, do all cops think that way? No, of course not. Nothing's absolute. But so many cops think that way because of the way they're trained. They put them through the academies across the country, convincing them that everybody has hidden knives and hand grenades and all these different things, and that they're all on PCP drugs, and that they're all capable of having extraordinary human strength, and that they can bust out of any situation. And they get these guys and women so paranoid that they just believe that the only thing to do is to shoot first or fire something first. Strike first, because bad things are going to happen if they don't. And that they need to be always in control. Compliance is the ultimate badge of honor, that you get the offender to comply with you no matter what you have to do. And you just keep escalating. And that's the way they're wired. Now, some of them are smart enough and they get enough years experience and they say, gee, everything they taught me in the academy is totally BS. And if you're going to survive right here on the streets and be successful, you have to ignore that. But they come out of the academy with a lot of brainwashing.
To push and not even push back. I was at a restaurant in Atlanta last night, and there were three officers eating dinner, and they were, I wore a flak vest when I was in the Army, and like, you know, you had all this crap around your waist and a flak vest. You have a Kevlar helmet on. You just, you know, your circumference of your torso is like 10 inches, 12 inches wider now because you have all this gear on. And that's how they're sitting there, because they got tear gas canisters, they got their taser, they got their pistol, they got all the things. And it's incredibly intimidating. And it doesn't present something to me that would be like, I need help, I'm going there. I would think that I'm going to go ask for help, and I'm going to be the one that tased them because I disturbed their dinner.
Well, that's the Europeans, particularly from the United Kingdom. They get a kick out of watching American cops, because largely in the United Kingdom, the cops are not heavily armed at all. And they see what we do here. Yeah, they see what we do here. They shake their heads in total disbelief of what a production we make of an officer. And I'm surprised. I mean, one of the reasons I suppose they have to maintain such high physical fitness standards is because you're carrying so much gear that if you weren't physically fit, you'd never be able to make it through the day.
You should probably go look at the officers in Butts County, man, because they are not physically fit. They are packing a few donuts around that midsection.
Well, that's true. I've noticed that every time I'm in the South, because I compare our relatively physically fit police force here in Albuquerque.
You have a max age, don't you, for your people?
I don't know if they have a max age, but it's a young force here.
Okay, maybe that's what you've described.
If you find anybody over 40, it's rarity. They're in leadership roles. I mean, but the regular patrol officers, it's a very young police force, very physically fit, very athletic looking. When you get pulled over in Albuquerque, I want you guys to shoot a video to me on your, what do you call it? You just use your camera and shoot us a video. When a pot-bellied officer pulls you over with an APD uniform, I want you to shoot that to us so we can put it on, because you're not going to see that happen here.
Got it.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right, we got a batch of 3 articles that are talking about the politics of felons in prison, out of prison, but the people that are directly impacted by the criminal justice system. I tried to find something from Rush where he was all up in arms about the Amendment 4 in Florida, where he was like, oh my God, this is going to open up a tidal wave of Democrats getting elected to different offices, blah, blah, blah. This art, at least the first one from the Marshall Project, is that one the one that has? Yeah, there's the Marshall Project one has a graph.
There's 2 of them that dispel that, and I've been saying that without the data.
Okay.
Because of just human knowledge and interacting with people in the criminal defense business, and knowing how right wing the people are that are in jail, they're worse than the population as a whole. But this actually documents what I've been saying.
And it seems to be highly, highly correlated to race. So you have white and non-white is really all I'm going to go after. And whites overwhelmingly support Trump, and non-whites overwhelmingly not support. And that's, to me, when the graph flips back and forth, that's where I see obviously the most, because the line moves the most. But just looking at the numbers and trying to just gauge what it is. And because whites are about 75% of the population, they are disproportionately unrepresented in prison, but it's still about, give or take, 50-50, I think. At least as in the South, it's about 50-50 of whites to non-whites in prison. So it just, like, anyway, that disparity, that idea that the prison population is going to vote blue doesn't seem to bear out in evidence.
Well, like I said, I've just known this from life experience, but seeing these articles, I couldn't help myself putting them in here, because researchers have come up with the same conclusion, that when they've gone and done the data, they see that these people are, I mean, Trump has amazing support in prison. I mean, amazing support.
And to come on the heels of that, there's an article from the Washington Post setting up a actual voting booth in the Cook County Jail. I don't know that this gets enough traction that if you are detained during that voting time, that you may have squandered your ability to vote. And I don't see how that's actually a legit thing. That totally seems like it's a civil liberties violation, that you are only alleged to have done something. You haven't been convicted of anything, that you should still be able to vote. And I realize there are logistics of getting voting systems into prison and all that, but that's their cost to bear. That's their burden to bear to keep up with your civil liberties to make it so that you can vote.
Well, I believe the article references a Supreme Court decision that says that you can vote while you're in pretrial detention. I mean, when I click on it, I'm getting the version to get 1 year for $29. But when I read this prior to last week, there's a reference that there's a Supreme Court case that says, in fact, you do retain the right to vote when you're pre-conviction.
But that would mean that they would have to provide it for you, and I wouldn't stake any money to say that, yeah, they're going to pass it around.
They're not, but this is an example of Cook County, which is Chicago. Mm-hmm. For those who don't recognize, this is a major urban detention facility becoming a precinct, so that the people who are in pretrial status on election day can vote. I mean, what a novel concept! I mean, that's why I put it in here, because it can be done. They're doing it.
If the will is there,
the will isn't there because they're afraid they're going to vote. They're going to vote Democrat.
Democrat, huh? Not Democratic, but Democrat.
Vote for the Democrat Party.
Tell me what the story is behind that again, please.
George W. Bush said he used the term Democrat Party back when he was president, and it's kind of like the drive-by media. He said they did a drive-by briefing, and the Rush latched onto the Democrat Party and the drive-by, and so he refers to all the traditional mainline media as the drive-bys. And the Democratic Party, that's not the name of the party. It's not the Democrat Party. You're a Democrat, but it's the Democratic Party. So I guess under my skin, when people won't say the Democratic Party, so when they do that, I retort with the Republican Party.
I see.
If you won't pronounce my party, I won't pronounce your party correctly.
He also said nuclear too.
Well, we've had more than one president say that. Carter, who was a physicist, said nuclear.
Okay, it sounds funnier when Bush says it, but maybe I've never heard Carter say it. Maybe it's a little bit
Carter,
not quite my then, time before my time, but close.
And then Reagan referred to the government as government.
Government. Well, I call them governors.
So yeah, he said government was typically, he left out the R, and people all the time refer to Washington, particularly the state of Washington, as Washington. They put an R in that's not there.
Well, no, that's colloquial. That's the vernacular in the local area, because I grew up saying Washington. And someone would pick on me relentlessly until I was like, oh, it's Washington, not Washington. But that's how they pronounce it in that area.
Yep. So you people in Washington, we really appreciate you.
And then to close things out, there's a final article also from the Marshall Project that's Trump's surprising popularity in prison. And I'm sure that I could posit some ideas of why that is, but I will refrain from that because I will get yelled at, I am sure.
Well, I just wanted people to have the information when you find yourself trembling that the Democrat Party is trying to get people in prison to vote. From my conversation with the people who are leadership in the Democrat Party, we don't actually think that we're going to get a whole bunch of votes out of it. We just think it's the right thing to do.
Yes,
that people, that the more participatory that we allow people who have records, that the better society we're going to have. So it's not some giant conspiracy of the Democrat Party. But if it were a giant conspiracy of the Democrat Party, the data from what I consider a reasonably reliable source suggests that the Democrat Party would be misguided to believe that it's going to result in a tremendous amount of new votes for the Democrat Party, because the people don't seem to support the Democrat Party that would benefit from this. That was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah. I have heard it proposed that the Democrats want more inclusive voting, and Team Red, Republicans, conservatives want less inclusive, less widely spread. And I can, just from one little incident that happened during the week, I go to a business meeting at lunch on Wednesdays, and a woman said something to the effect of that these ignorant people, God, and they have the right to vote. And I was like, Well, how would you make the determination of who can or can't vote? It, like, if you just want to start there, should it be by age? Should it be by income? Should it be by IQ? Well, the easiest answer is to just say everybody can vote. All people can vote all the time.
Well, I'm not a spokesperson for the Republican Party, but I can tell you that they are very terrified of people voting. They continuously try to make it more difficult by they're not big supporters of early voting of extended periods of time. They're not big supporters of letting people vote without having a governmentally issued ID because of this boogeyman of fraud. Of course, nobody can find any document cases of fraud. You know, you keep asking for it. And, you know, yes. Like in my state, I keep saying, well, would you please show us? I mean, they've brought proof to us that dead people have voted. But the only problem is they weren't dead when they voted. People, you know, in an extended early voting period, people, particularly elderly, but some people died. They're not elderly, but we hear this scare story about dead people vote. Well, they do in fact vote, but they vote while they're alive, and then when the votes are tabulated, people have actually in fact died. But they say that without a governmentally issued ID, that there'll be all this rampant fraud. But it just they can't substantiate the claim, and. You come out of prison, say your votes are automatically, right to vote is automatically restored, but you haven't got your ID together yet because of all the barriers of real ID. You're disenfranchised, but yet you have the right to vote. And then as they've closed, your state was a good example in the gubernatorial election. Mm-hmm. There were like hundreds of voter machines that were impounded for whatever reason. There was some investigation going on. They had impounded voting machines. And they reduced the number of voting machines in the Democrat areas where that people were likely to be Democrats had to travel greater distances to vote, and it suppressed the Democratic vote in the urban Atlanta area, and Stacey Abrams lost the governor's race and to the person who was running the elections, who ultimately became governor. Governor Kemp was the elections manager because he was Secretary of State at the time.
Not only just in the Atlanta portion, also in the super duper out in the middle of nowhere rural areas, I've heard some number used that for every mile or 10 miles that you the percentage of people that vote goes down by some factor. So yeah, you have people with very low incomes, possibly no transportation. Like it makes it significantly harder for them to go vote, and then they're just like, screw it, I'm not going to vote.
Well, yes, and then with the technological evolution we've had, I think I'm not a guru of this, but I think we could securely have people vote online. Apparently, the Census Bureau is comfortable enough that they can do something like the census online, and this is Trump administration running the census. I would think that we could get enough personal information because we do have a giant database of all the vital records out there that's available to the government. I would think that we could figure out if people are eligible to vote by virtue of they are either a naturalized citizen or born in the United States. I don't think that all this paranoia about fraud, I think is a smokescreen for they just don't want people to vote. And I can't speak for why they don't want people to vote. You'd have to ask them.
Yeah. I don't know that the stakes would be too high to do online voting to make a secure system that would support it without to keep the integrity up. There is an open source. There's an open research project thing of how to do secure voting machines and all that stuff. And maybe we can dive into that as we get closer to the election of how that system is in play. But all of the systems that were made by these proprietary companies, and they're 20 years old and they're using Windows 95 or something like that, they're complete garbage. They put them into hacker conferences and in 75 seconds, they're wide open for people to manipulate the vote. And that's a on-premise voting machine. Forget trying to do something online where grandma's using an old computer, hasn't been patched in 12 years. It that would be a nightmare. I don't know that we can get there, Larry. I just don't.
Well, can we actually get there by having mail-in votes? I think they did that in Washington this primary. They did it by mail, if I'm not mistaken.
I know California lets you do that. I don't know that they require it, but I think there is a state that does everybody's mail-in vote, right? Like you just said,
well, I was thinking the Washington. I thought
Washington.
One of those liberal do-good states.
Bastards. God. And then you don't have to. The one thing about that, though, to me, is that if there's some sort of earth-shattering news that comes out the day before the, like, what are you supposed to do then? You've already cast your vote.
Well, Well, that's the problem that you have with early voting. That's why I'm typically not an early voter. You need, as far as I'm concerned, wait as long as you possibly can to gather as much information as you can to be a better informed voter. But if you vote 2 weeks before the election, a lot can change. At least in my mind, a lot can change. But when you do a mail-in vote, wouldn't the same thing?
Totally.
If you mail the ballot, because you can't go retrieve it and say, I want my ballot back.
Nope, because it's supposed to be anonymous. So you couldn't go find that your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, that's your voting number, and you want to go pull that back. I don't know how to solve that one, man. That's way above my pay grade. Here's an article from Rewire News that says, you don't even treat animals the way I was treated, pregnant and incarcerated. This is a profile of a woman who was just treated like utter crap while she was pregnant and incarcerated. We just have no systems in place to handle that a woman has an extra little body attached to her inside, how she's supposed to be treated with any level of compassion and empathy. And it's just bizarre to me that we would treat people this way, knowing that they're about to bring another little human into the world.
Well, I was shocked when I read it, and this is actually not far from us here. This is a place called La Plata County, which is in the Four Corners area of Colorado and New Mexico, and where the four states come together. And the seat would be Durango, but apparently they did not believe this woman, although they knew she was pregnant. They didn't believe that she was on the verge of giving birth. And I don't know how since I haven't been pregnant, I don't know all the ins and outs. We probably need to put one of the women that's in chat on here, but I can't imagine that it would be easy to fake that you're in that position. I mean, I would think there would be, as long as we've delivered children, that we would kind of be able to pick up on when you're in a condition where you need attention.
Seems very strange. And as that little clip says, that your water breaks, you're in agony. How are you supposed to do anything? Like, you're going to grab the scalpel or whatever would be nearby and start stabbing people to escape? And then further down the line, like in the next handful of minutes, there's going to be this little entity that pops out that needs love, attention, caring. Seems it would be best for mom that would be the most optimal caregiver of the child as soon as he comes out, or she comes out. And
this is just appalling. But read it. For 3 days in 2013, officers ignored her pleas as bleeding continued and abdominal pain worsened. Instead of being taken to hospital, Olson was the woman's name, was brought to a medical observation cell where jail officials used a pad count, a method of monitoring the number of pads a patient sanitizes with blood to estimate how much she was bleeding. They gave me 2 pads and sent me to a single cell by myself, and I kept bleeding and it hurt so bad. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. I'm going to die. And the guards told her she needed to get a hold of herself.
Right,
she was overreacting. Well, I mean, I'm assuming that the bulk of the guards are probably male.
Right.
And how can you, as a male, tell someone is undergoing an experience that you have a difficulty, if not impossible, to relate to? How can you tell them to get a hold of themselves? Because unless you're a medical professional, I doubt you have any idea what they're going through.
I would agree.
And it says she was rushed to the hospital where she went emergency surgery for a ruptured, what is that there? Atopic pregnancy, whatever
ectopic.
That means.
It's ectopic.
Ectopic. Okay, what does that mean?
That part I have no idea, but let's just say that the uterus has exploded, something like that.
So, but
that sounds bad.
I don't understand how that we can, it's like, really? The worst thing that can happen is you'd be premature, that you wouldn't be ready to have the baby. That's, I think, the worst thing that can happen.
I have been told that it is when the egg ruptures in the tubes. So the fallopian tubes, that there are some eggs that go explodey in the fallopian tubes.
And do we have this from a credible source in our vast chat room?
We have 3 ladies in chat, and 2 of them have confirmed that this can kill you. So that sounds like a good enough polling by me.
We're ready to let a person possibly lose their life and the baby because of what?
Because they committed some crime. They stole $25 from the local corner store.
I can't take this any longer.
All right. Well, then let's move over to an article from the dailypress.com. After Virginia prison strip searched an 8-year-old state lawmakers passed 4 bills to limit the practice. It took someone searching an 8-year-old for them to pass legislation from what people would like to refer to as something like common sense, right? It takes a law to say that thou shalt not search people under the age of something. And that's unbelievable. 8-year-old. Hey, honey, you got to get strip searched. You got to pull down your pants for this adult so that he can look at your junk to make sure that you're not smuggling in anything.
Well, again, prisons are afforded broad discretion doing things, and you can do almost anything with an articulable cause. And it would be a very high standard before I'd allow strip search of an 8-year-old. But they don't tend to think that way. We've got the power. We can do this. And by golly, it's our policy, and we're going to do it. And nobody says, no, wait a minute. We're not going to strip search an 8-year-old. The only way I'm going to do that is if you can show me that the mom was putting something in their private areas before. If we've got some evidence where we need to do a strip search, but we don't strip search kids here. Sorry, that doesn't happen under my watch. But nobody will say that. And that we have to pass a law to get you to not do what you have better sense to do if you had any sense to start with.
Do you think that these are people that are, you know, they've read the SOP and it says that they're going to strip search all individuals coming into visitation? So it's like, well, chief said I got to strip search everybody coming into visitation. You are a person, right? So, well, take them off. You got to go.
I don't know the particulars of it, but there again, we criticize people who served in previous militaries for following orders. And even if it is in the SOP, standard operating procedures, I would say, no, sir, I'm not going to strip search an 8-year-old unless I have some cause. I mean, you can do it if you want to, but I'm just not going to do it. So, I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen if you say, no, I won't do that? The absolute worst thing happen would be what?
They would fire you.
That's the worst thing.
That it is.
Do you think that it would go? Do you think that would go? I mean, first of all, that's not death. That most people that have been fired, very few that I know of that's resulted in their death. But that's the worst thing that can happen. The good thing that could happen is if maybe you did it, perhaps maybe one of your coworkers would do it next time. Mm-hmm. And perhaps maybe the example of saying, no, sir, we're not going to do that. Perhaps maybe they would rethink their policies. Maybe.
Maybe. And it would be an interesting case to go watch if you brought things to some sort of court hearing about trying to get your unemployment benefits. So you were fired. Why? Because there was an 8-year-old in the visitation room and I was forced to strip search him and I refused. I have to think that some level of rationality would then come forward and the judge would be like, yes, give the guy his unemployment insurance.
Well, it would vary according to the hearing officer. Now, we heard in the confirmation hearings Gorsuch, that when the person abandoned their truck when it was 40 below zero, they're about to freeze to death, that they violated company policy and they could be fired, and that he felt sympathy for the person, but they violated company policy. So depending on who conducted the hearing, you might have an officer that say, well, I'm sorry, but you refused. And according to my guidelines, if a person is willfully disobedient to their employer, I have to disallow the benefits. That could happen. But then you would take it up on appeal. And assuming that you have some value about your life, assuming that you're not a slug to start with, I'm guessing in this time of full employment that you could possibly find another job, maybe.
Larry, let's move over to our feature segment of the night, which is going to be about prisons and coronavirus. The first article is really just like, huh, this comes out of the mirror.co.uk. It's coronavirus 6 dead as prison riots sparked by emergency laws sweep Italy. Obviously, this isn't the U.S., and I don't know that this is happening. Obviously, this just happened at Parchment with a riot, but this wasn't related to the virus, but you have people super closed quarters. They can't separate, like what's the term? I keep forgetting the term, but you keep yourself distance, like 3 feet distance from people.
Social distancing.
Social distancing. That becomes hard when you're like in a 40 by 40 room with 100 dudes or chicks, whichever way. Anyway, so a riot breaks out and people are dying, and they manage to get their way up onto the roof. That looks like a lot of fun there.
Well, it does. They should have just shot them off the top of the roof.
I can almost guarantee you that would have been the response in the U.S., Larry. I don't know that they would have been. They wouldn't use kid gloves to try and get them to calm down. They would have had to get some snipers and plop them off the roof.
Well, we can't take a chance of them getting outside the prison walls. We have to break the riot and the uprising. We have to put it down because bad things can happen.
Would you envision that this scenario plays out in the United States? A riot breaking out inside the walls?
Over this virus?
Uh-huh.
I do have that fear of that happening. In fact, it's been on my radar, and I've actually written a little something for the Defense Lawyers Association here about things that we can do to diminish that possibility. But yes, I think that panic can cause people to do things that they would not do in normal circumstances. Now, we would all agree that a prison environment, a particular U.S. prison, by and large, is not an ideal environment for people to think rationally because of the stresses of being incarcerated and the harsh conditions that most of our prisons, the reality of what the conditions are. So when you've got someone who's suspected of being infected, and the way this is going to go down, if it goes down the way I suspect it might go down, would be that the prisons will be slow to detect who's infected because it's not our highest of priority. When you start thinking about who we're going to test, you'd think that it would be, but it's not going to be our highest of priority. So we'll end up having a prison that has several infected people before we figure it out. And then management of the prison is stuck with a facility that really isn't designed for isolation and contained breathing of air that you wouldn't spread it through the ventilation system. There's so many things about prison life that make it difficult for the person. I could even read the points I put in my writing to the defense lawyers. We've got facilities are largely not designed for good hygiene. They're designed to keep them from being flooded and people using excessive amounts of water. And so the water controls are typically running for a couple of minutes, reduce pressure. Oftentimes, buttons have to be held to keep the continuous flow of water. The flow of water is not usually a good forceful amount of water. You got a little trickle of water coming out, particularly in older facilities, and you've got a lack of a lot of soap and sanitation for the inmates to use. So if you're so desirable, if it's your desire to maintain good hygiene, you've got a little trickle of water that's either too hot or too cold, and it won't run for very long, and you can't really do the sustained hand washing that you need to do. And then you've got these people that are infected that are unbeknownst to you, and when the prison finds out that they've got a population of 963 people infected, they don't have anywhere to put these people.
Yeah.
That will contain them. They don't have isolation chambers that have contained oxygen supplies.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the risk of a rapidly spreading epidemic in prisons. And then they're doing they're doing some of the right things. I shouldn't say all the wrong things. They're doing some of the right things, but they're doing some additional things that are not right. They're doing the social distancing by cutting off visits from the outside, from family and from attorneys. Even legal professionals are being told you can't have visits.
Right.
That I could go along with, but that's one step of the many steps that they need to take. They're not doing things that would actually help contain the spread of the infection if it actually gets into prison. Rather than doing weekly laundry, giving people weekly changes of sheets and changes of their jumpsuit, they should probably do that 3 times a week now. The laundry facility should be put on 24-hour day operations so that all the inmates' clothing that they personally own and all the inmates' clothing and linen that's issued is continuously being churned and cleaned. They need to increase the amount of sanitation supplies that are available to the inmates so that they can clean, and require that these housing units be robustly cleaned every day. And they need to provide an alternative to those visits that are being canceled. They need to say, for example, we're going to get with Securus and we'll pick up the tab for the phone calls. Or Securus, we're going to ask you to turn off the charge for the phone calls so that people can maintain contact with their families. It's part of a compromise of conveying to the inmates, we are inconveniencing you and we're taking away one of your most cherished privileges, but we're also showing you that we're trying to keep you safe by giving you more clothing, by giving you more visitation by telephone, and making some concessions on our part so that this is not just how we can punish you. If you cut off family visits and you cut off attorney visits, and these people feel completely isolated, do you think good things are going to come out of this?
Certainly not. Which would something you said just a second ago brings up something from the appeal article talking about pressure being put on the governor of New York. These guys, gals, are working. They're going to use inmates. I think they said, but there are nearly 100 incarcerated people will be making hand sanitizer for just cents on the hour. But because one of the components of the hand sanitizer is alcohol, that the inmates can't then have the sanitizer. So you can make it, but you can't have it.
Oh, well, they should have thought about that before they got in there.
I know. And for all the people that are not so informed, and the hand sanitizer that you normally get kills 99.99999% of bacteria, the coronavirus isn't a bacteria. So it doesn't necessarily kill it. So you're kind of screwed.
Well, thanks a lot.
I'm sorry. So all the people with the Lysol wipes, that's probably a better approach. It's not as convenient, but you need the alcohol.
So my brother, who drove all the way to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, to get some hand sanitizer, he wasted his time. In other words,
I am not going to say he's wasting his time, because I think even like the action of rubbing is a very good idea, but I don't think it's going to actually kill the virus. Anywho, there's that piece coming from the New York side of things.
Well, it disturbs me that I haven't seen several of our sheriff's departments here posted their plans in response to a public call from the ACLU and from activists saying, what are your plans? And all the plans are lacking in terms of the things that I just mentioned. You know, it's like, it's cutting off visits. That's their first answer. Well, unless your staff is all living on the compound and forbidden to leave the prison compound and not having any contact with anyone off the compound, you're not making, I mean, you're making some progress. You're reducing the chances of exposure, but you're still got the risk, because these people are going home. They're going out to the world. They're having contact, and they're going to bring this virus back into the prison. So the thing that's missing is how to increase the sanitation and stop the spread from within the prison. What about getting people that are high risk out of prison temporarily? Iran, which is not thought of being as one of the most forward-thinking nations on Earth, they release thousands of prisoners now. What would be wrong with us taking the vulnerable elderly and the ones who have health issues that make them more susceptible to you're not going to die. If you're healthy, you're likely not going to die if you get this. But if you're not so healthy and you have a compromised immune system, the complications could result in your death. What would be wrong with us taking those more vulnerable inmates and going ahead and using this fancy technology that we talk about how wonderful it is, that's an alternative to prison, and taking these people and getting them out of prison until this crisis abates? That would be a positive step. And these people are not going to flee the United States. They're not going to disappear into oblivion. And we could do that. And the sanitation stuff, the laundry, running your laundry 24 hours a day, I don't know what you'd have to run 24 hours a day, but increase in the operations. You've got trustees. You can award those jobs. You can pay them nothing, or just give them privileges, or pay them pennies on an hour to run laundry. And it's a stress on the machines, but you can run laundry basically around the clock.
You can bring in pizza. Freshly. I guarantee you people will work for pizza in prison.
Yeah, and you can all of a sudden have a much cleaner environment. It won't guarantee no spread, but it'll certainly help diminish it, because right now those stainless steel tables where people are hacking and sneezing and everything all day long, and they're getting, I mean, how often did you see those tables being sanitized properly when you were incarcerated?
I saw them being, but I don't know about properly. And then how would you even go investigate that it was done? Are you going to get some sort of like UV, like the stuff that you see in CSI where they spray something and they put on like the blue glasses with the blue light or whatever it is, and they show you what was actually there? Nobody does that crap.
Well, no, but when you're talking about a correctional facility, the the all indications I have is that sanitation is kind of lax.
It is. Totally agree with you.
They don't provide enough of the right stuff because of security concerns. You know, we can't have mop buckets with handles and stuff like that. We can't have, well, you just mentioned alcohol, but we have all these things we can't have. And I think it's time to look the other way on some of this stuff and say, in this crisis, we're going to have to bend the rules, kind of like when the Indianapolis was after the ship was sunk and all the many hundreds of sailors were eaten up by the sharks, and they were finally discovered, and there was a rescue ship on the horizon, mm-hmm. and they turned on their lights on the captain's orders, even though they were sitting target for attack themselves. But the captain said, "I've got to give these men hope that are in the water, that someone's coming for them." So we're making ourselves a target to give these other men in the water hope. And that's kind of what you're doing here. You're telling these people, we can't guarantee you that you're not going to be infected, but we can guarantee you that everything that can be done reasonably, we're doing because we care about your safety. And that message has not been conveyed from any correctional administrator that I've heard of. All they've conveyed is we're cutting your visits off.
Can we move things over? I know we have this other article that's talking about the BOP's readiness, but you know, we've kind of already swirled around it enough. I have had conversations with more than one person talking about the constitutionality side of things, of locking cities down, of, you know, restricting sales of different kinds of items, or the price gouging restrictions. And I can see where the person is coming from, that, damn it, we're a free society. If I want to sell my roll of toilet paper for $100, F you, I've got it. You want it. Give me your $100. But I'm still thinking about 80-year-old grandmother that needs some toilet paper. She is not capable of going down to the store and fighting for that toilet paper, that we as a society would then create some sort of bubble that keeps people from hoarding, keep people from gouging. These are things that would happen within a constitutional framework from an executive order. Like, these are things that exist. They're not unknown things, and they're not the start of anarchy. They're not the start of a dictatorship inside of the United States. I'm just baffled about how we would go from our society that is at least reasonably free to having some sort of complete control. I don't want to even say like Russia, but North Korea, where everything is micromanaged. Have you heard of these kinds of things, quote unquote, coming down the pike?
I have heard that there's a conspiracy theorists are out there about, you know, this is a conspiracy to gain more control of the population and all this, that, and other. But the only problem is we've had these public health epidemics, pandemics, whatever they were properly referred to. We've had these issues going back for decades and decades of my life. I tell people, well, I remember 1968 when I was quite young, we had the Hong Kong flu. And then in 75, we had the swine flu that affected a lot of people. And the president of the United States rolled up his sleeve on national TV and took his swine flu vaccine and said to everybody, please do this to prevent the spread of flu. And we've had avian flu, bird flu, H1N1, I mean, the 2008, 2009, another swine flu outbreak. I mean, we've had all these things. And if it was a giant conspiracy to get control of the people, why didn't they do it in all these previous ones? Why didn't they do it? I mean, it's a bit far-fetched. I think the public health officials are trying to make the best decisions, and they're humans, and they're not going to make the best decisions because there's disagreement among professionals about what the best course of action is. Dr. Fauci has one opinion, and another medical expert mm-hmm. may have another opinion about what's to be done. But I don't see a giant conspiracy to deprive Americans of their liberty. Maybe I'm naive, but I just don't see it.
I mean, but you've been around since like the Roman Empire. So you've seen, if it's going to happen, it's happened and you've seen it.
Well, I mean, this administration, who is all about freedom, this would be something you'd expect from Bernie and from the Democrat Party. I mean, you wouldn't expect this freedom-loving administration to be trying to restrict people's liberties, would you?
Definitely not. I received one of the articles was from Champaign, Illinois, and they were talking about like restricting gun sales or ammunition sales, alcohol sales. Like the alcohol one, I can like at least get my head around. And you don't want people getting shit faced and run around and then causing riots because they're all drunk and they want to, whatever, they want to show out. So, I mean, like, I can at least understand that. And then that could possibly lead to people buying guns and then ammunition and shooting people. I can see why they would do it. But even if they did do it, it seems like it would be for a highly targeted for 1 week, 2 weeks, whatever, along with curfews until 7 p.m. or daylight hours. Like it, they are constitutional. They are available to the executive to make these decisions to happen. Is that fair?
Well, each executive action will have to be examined as it comes down to determine if there's encroachment in the Constitution at a time of crisis like we potentially are in right now. It's not an epidemic yet where there's millions of people infected. But I think from what I'm hearing, and I'm no expert, of course, but what I'm hearing, it has the potential to do that, to be that. And therefore, at state and federal level, executives are given a lot of power in emergency situations, particularly when the public health is in jeopardy, to issue orders. And again, just like with the travel ban early on in the Trump presidency, if people think that they have gone too far, that's what the courts are open for. So you can file your action and tell the court why that this executive action is unconstitutional, and we'll let the courts decide it, right?
That's how it seems to me, Larry.
I'm not sure about the gun restrictions. I mean, other than if you're worried about people going postal, and for those who are under 30, you don't hear that term much anymore. But for going postal was when most of the mass shootings that occurred in modern U.S. time were disgruntled ex or current postal employees who went back to their boss and shot up the boss and coworkers and stuff. And so thus the term going postal. If this crisis became so severe that people couldn't get food and they couldn't do their basic things they need to do to stay alive, I suppose that there could be some concern of people resorting to extreme measures, including the use of weapons. I mean, if you're going to starve to death and there's food to be had, and I mean, anything's possible, but I don't know the connection of why the order would exclude the firearms. I'm not familiar with what their thinking was.
I can rationalize around it of being like, well, you don't want new people running around with weapons, you know, just on the whim of some sort of zombie apocalypse, whatever. It seems
well. It says it seems number six, me. Number six in the executive order on the one that's in the article. It says in bold that order discontinuance of selling, distributing, dispensing, or giving away of explosives or explosive agents, firearms or ammunition or any of any character whatsoever. Is this an executive order that's already been issued?
I think that one is like maybe being in talks. I mean, you know, that's the one that I heard about, but I think that's just in talks. I don't know that it's been executed. Anywho, I just wanted your policy, your, you know, all of your expertise and years of dealing with, you know, even after 9/11, that would have been one of the biggest in like our national level of tragedies. But this outbreak on a national scale is similar to a Hurricane Andrew or, you know, Hurricane Sandy in New York a few years back. Like it's just on a nationwide scale that you have to protect the infrastructure and keep people from gouging prices and hoarding things and then just messing up the whole civilization as a whole.
Well, on that point, on the gouging, I think that one's really pretty simple. That I mean, yes, in a free country, you get to sell things for the going rate, what a willing buyer and a willing seller would agree upon. But those are in normal circumstances where you have no extraneous factors at play and an emergency situation, whether it be a hurricane or some natural disaster that causes those normal forces to no longer be controlling the transaction. Then we try to protect people from price gouging because that's exploitation. Your $7 pack of Charmin doesn't magically become worth $150 except for the emergency that you're profiting from. And so we've long since recognized price gouging as being something that's problematic, and people can go to jail for price gouging. But this actually is an order that's been issued by Mayor Deborah Frank Feenan.
Okay.
Of Champaign. This order has already been issued. The executive order allows the city to, this is what was reported on WAND Channel 17. So apparently this is what's in place right now.
Do you see that as like a gateway to martial law, to all of, like, some sort of complete total government takeover and the eradication of the Constitution and all of our civil liberties, yada yada yada?
No, I don't. We're so far from that with in a democratically elected system of governance. Yes, it's always good to talk. I mean, as old as I am, I've heard, I think, since the Nixon administration about how he was going to declare martial law and he was going to hang on to the presidency. And then every president since then, except for, I don't think I remember hearing about Carter, but certainly a lot of presidents were going to hang on to power. Now I'm hearing about Trump that he's not going to leave office. He's going to leave office one way or the other when his time is up. And if he were to try to cling on to power, we have enough institutions left that are functional that he would be removed by force if necessary. And in the case of martial law, if we're not in a real emergency that justifies it, the public would never tolerate it in what's largely a free society. So, it would be dissolved by the people.
Yeah.
And Larry, don't you understand, if martial law, people are not allowed to vote? Yes, I would understand in theory if you had martial law that people wouldn't be allowed to vote. But what they would be allowed to do, you wouldn't be able to turn off the telephones. You wouldn't be able to turn off Twitter. You wouldn't be able to turn off Facebook. And you wouldn't be able to turn off all the people if they decide to pour to the street and decide that we're going to march on City Hall and we're not going to take this anymore. I mean, unless you're willing to have a complete bloodbath, which we've learned that some countries are not willing when there's an uprising to have a complete, but that's how the Soviet Union collapsed, because the powers running the old Soviet Union were not willing to have a complete bloodbath when the uprising of the people was happening back in 89 and 90. And in the United States, you would never be able to impose martial law for very long because the people wouldn't stand for it, in my view. And I could be wrong, but I just don't see the people would stand for having their liberties completely eradicated and say, well, I guess we'll just lay down and take it.
Do you want to play these last two clips that we have?
I think they would be fun to play, yes. This is in terms of the relief package for the all the shutdowns and cancellations. There's a lot of hardships going to be imposed on people by forced shutdowns and cancellations, school closures. And then there'll be a lot of economic dislocation because as business contracts as a result of cancellations, people, it's very unlikely that the sports arenas that are having all their events canceled, it's very unlikely that they're going to continue to pay the people. Now, some of the sports figures have stepped forward and said, we're going to personally donate. And some of the team organizations have said, we're going to personally donate. But what this deals with is the issue of where those generous donations haven't materialized, the issue of sick leave for folks. And this is Senator Kamala Harris talking about sick leave and about the posture of the United States and those who oppose sick leave and the downside of the short-sightedness of that. And then there's a second clip that talks about how the U.S. compares with the rest of the advanced world in terms of sick leave and where we rate, because we think of ourselves as being number one in everything. You know, we're the greatest, and this assuming his figures are accurate. And again, just like the earlier clip, I'm not going to say I've researched his figures. I'm going to say these are his figures and we're taking them at face value. But
I will spoil one thing accurate. About it. We are number one on this list.
Well, it's not number one in a good way.
All right. So here's the Kamala Harris clip.
This is bigger than the individual who receives the paid family leave. This is literally about every other person that they will come in contact with because they are not staying at home. It's really important for people to understand. It is in everyone's best interest that all workers receive paid family leave, because otherwise they're going to be sitting next to you on the bus. They're going to be walking by you down the street. They may be serving your food. They may be taking care of your children. They may be your neighbor. It is in everyone's collective and best interest that we provide paid family and sick leave to people who are sick with the coronavirus. There are people in America, in fact, two-thirds of low-income workers, do not have paid sick leave. And when presented with the issue of whether they will stay at home while they're sick, or feed their babies, or keep a roof over their head, it is logical to believe that they will go to work so that they can keep taking care of their family. So in the midst of this public health crisis, let us understand that one of the most significant and effective ways that we're going to slow down this virus is to make sure that when people are sick, they stay at home.
They should stay home, and it is in the interest of the public that they stay home, but then that they also don't, lack of a better word, starve to death.
Well, and that's one of those things where I was talking to a friend of mine about, who's staunchly anti-socialism. I said, well, you know, United States, have you ever looked at Social Security? That's a social program. And, well, I paid into it. I said, yeah, but most people get more out than they ever put into it. But that's a discussion for another podcast. It's in our collective interest that we extend a little bit of social generosity to these people. And the question is, who pays for it? Is that a cost that the government should force on employers? Or is that something that we should, as taxpayers, all collectively pitch into? But it's in our interest that sick people not go to work, particularly when they serve the public. But even if they don't serve the public, you're going to encounter the public and going back and forth to work. So it's kind of a no-brainer, as people are fond of saying. This one seems like that sick leave is kind of a function of a maturing, modern, evolving society that we'd recognize that should be a part of a compensation package. But then we have the second clip that tells about where we stand as the United States versus the world.
But before we hit that, I just want to bring up, what about all the people that are in the quote unquote gig economy that are 1099s, or, you know, they're just working job to job to job. They don't have a quote unquote employer that could then feed them with some kind of sick leave benefit anyway. What are they supposed to do? They're still screwed even if this, with this bill.
Well, that's kind of the one of the gaps of our society, particularly with the gig economy, as you refer to it. The people, ideally, you'd be self-sufficient. But the reality is that people don't save. They don't hoard their money. They consume in this country, and they generally consume at a level higher than what they can afford to consume. And they're not prepared for even a short period of sickness, much less a protracted period of absence from work. Right. Most people can't withstand that.
All right, here's the second clip.
Simple fact, as Senator Harris made clear, is that if an employee gets sick and has to choose between going to work and feeding their family or risking staying home and not getting paid, or worse, getting fired, they're going to show up to work. Who wouldn't? And yet that puts everyone else at risk, other employees and customers and the general public. So the responsibility cannot be on the employee to choose whether or not they should provide for their family and put food on the table, because that's not a decision that someone should ever have to make. That decision has to be mandated by the government. Because while an employer's job is to make money, the government's job is to keep its citizens safe. Mandating paid sick leave would do exactly that. And yet our government seems to be one of the only ones in the world who hasn't figured that out. The United States has 0 days of mandated sick leave. Only two other industrialized nations have a similar lack of protections. And yet we are the only one with the distinction of being the richest country on the face of the earth. Meanwhile, if you get a life-threatening illness like cancer in Luxembourg or Norway, you can get up to 50 days paid sick leave. You can get 48 in Finland, 45 in Austria, 44 in Germany, just to name a few. But in the United States of America, the shining city on a hill, you get zero.
Well, there you go. So yeah, number one at the bottom of the list is what I was referring to there, Larry.
Yeah, well, that's why I was saying that we're number one, depending on how you invert the list. But if people were to... Don't take this as we don't love America. We still love America just as much as you do. But we are actually looking at how to make this lovely, shining city on the hill even better than it already is. And somehow or another, that should not translate into not loving this country. We look around the world and we manage to see that they survive and thrive doing these things. Germany is not exactly a basket case economically. Very few people would say that about Germany. But yet they manage to take care of their people. And how do they do that? Well, they make that their priority.
Do you want to go over this final item with the Idaho bill?
Sure, that's our lightning round for today.
Yeah, we're going to try and start doing something where I I pepper Larry with bunches of questions or articles, and he gives me like one or two line answers. Anyway, this next article comes from KTVB. Idaho bill would mandate payouts for certain wrongful convictions. So what happens here?
Well, if it becomes law, they would get between $60,000 and $75,000 a year. If they're on death row, they'd get $75,000 for all the time they were on death row, and otherwise they'd get $60,000 a year. And I'm not real clear on all the nuances because I didn't pull the bill. But Idaho is like my state; it's one of 15 where there is no compensation on the books. And I'd like for our state to move in that direction also. But you've got people who are convicted through the system, their appeals fail, and then decades later, after the prosecution stops fighting to overturn their conviction, they somehow or another overcome that enormous hurdle and show that they didn't commit the crime. And then they've been in prison for many years, sometimes decades. This guy that's the feature in the story was convicted in 1983 of kidnapping and raping and murdering a 9-year-old girl. The only problem is he didn't do it.
Hmm.
That's the only problem. But it wasn't until 2001. It wasn't until 2001 when DNA tests, which were not available when his case was first tried, did he end up clearing his name, and he was later freed and spent 23 hours a day for 17 years in isolation.
Wow.
And we don't want to give him any money, really. What kind of society would object to paying? Yes, we can't be perfect. We understand that. We're humans. We will make mistakes. Some will be unintentional and some will be deliberate. But we can give people some compensation for our mistakes. Well, how could you oppose that? How could even the Republicans oppose that? This should be something that's totally bipartisan, that your famous bipartisanship should kick in here. If we've made a mistake, we should want to compensate people for our mistake. This should be so easy.
All right. Well, that's Larry has spoken on that one.
That was a lightning round for that.
I only have one other area of things that I would like to cover, and we can skip it if you want to, but it is about the Georgia House is in the process of voting on a bill. It's called House Bill 720 that would authorize the state police to, the county sheriffs to put signs in front of people's yards. Do you want to go over that, or do you want to just skip it for now?
We could do a brief touch on it. The House Bill 720, which has passed the House of Representatives in the state of Georgia, and it moved over to the Senate, which it's not moving in the Senate because they suspended the session due to the health concerns. And they've got 11 days remaining to run in their 40-day session, and they don't know when they're going to reconvene. But we litigated on this issue of the signs and butts in Spalding County, and we're winning. Both instances, we're winning two different courts. One in the Northern District, one in the Middle District of Georgia. We're winning in both. But we fully anticipated that as a result of our litigation, since we pointed out so eloquently that the sheriff didn't have any authority, that it would be an easier case to win. But what I guess I wasn't as eloquent in is that even if the sheriff had the authority, we still think we could win because it's an issue of the First Amendment. It's an issue of the Constitution. It's an issue of compelled speech. And it's an issue of failing to narrowly tailor. And therefore, you just can't do the blanket requirement of putting up signs on Halloween. We believe that this bill will ultimately, when they reconvene, it will ultimately pass the Senate. And we believe that Governor Brian Kemp will sign it. And we believe we'll be back in court arguing the exact same thing that we've already won on, that we'll just extract the argument that the sheriff lacked any authority. And we'd say that even though that now there is the authority, that this makes it still no more constitutional than it has been. And when the court does their analysis, they're going to conclude, yes, we're supposed to give deference to the legislature. We presume it's constitutional upon enactment, and they will make that presumption. They'll look at it and they'll say it stopped. And we intend that when it's signed, which we expect it will be, we intend to go right back into court again and say, now, judge, enjoin the entire state and tell the state of Georgia, all the sheriffs, that you can't do this. That's our intent. And that we had anticipated this. It's no great surprise. There's no brilliance out there that thought of this, that likes to think that they were ahead of the curve and that they knew this. We knew this was going to happen also. But if we failed to litigate, if we had failed to file the lawsuits in the two counties we did, what we had was a cascading effect of Georgia's 159 counties, The sheriffs were being directed and encouraged by the Georgia Sheriff's Association, who produced the signs and the recommendation based on their legal analysis that they could do this and get away with it. We had other sheriffs who had announced that they were going to do it, and we gave a cease and desist letter, for example, in Ben Hill County. As far as we know, they didn't do the signs in Ben Hill County, but we had what was going to be a cascading effect of sheriffs. And had we stood idly by and let it go from 1, 2, 3, 12, 15, 17, 21, 42, and having a whole number of sheriffs, then the litigation would have been far more complicated. We'd have had a whole lot more defendants to try to serve. We'd have had a whole lot more hesitance by the judge to intervene because it would have become established practice at that point. It's kind of like when we went into court, when the challenge was filed under International Megan's Law, stuff that they had been doing as a result of the Adam Walsh Act for nearly a decade was being all of a sudden called into question. And the court was hesitant to intervene because they had been sending those notices for the better part of 10 years. And so therefore, we chose not to allow that to happen. We chose to not turn a blind eye to a sheriff inventing requirements because we were afraid that they were going to invent additional requirements. And where would they stop? So we think we did the right thing. We're confident we're going to win. And the people out there that are negative naysayers, there'll be negative naysayers out there no matter what you do.
But even still, and my county hasn't done it, but that doesn't mean next year that they don't decide to start doing it. And we could win in court even with the statute in place, in the next round of court battles. Granted, that means more funding. And that means that we start litigation from scratch. Granted, we have paperwork. We already have like case history to go from, but we still have to develop the case from scratch, right?
Well, if depending on if this thing gets enacted, if they do any narrow tailoring, it could be that they do such a narrow tailoring that they could conceivably come up with a Halloween sign scheme that would be constitutional. I doubt it, but you could do it.
Right.
But let's assume that they don't. Well, if it becomes state law, there would be some sheriffs, like in New Mexico, that say even though it's a state law and the red flag on the picking up the guns and the extreme risk orders, we're not going to enforce them. There could be some sheriffs that'll say, I'm not going to enforce this. But more than likely, they would choose to enforce the law. At that point, we would have to litigate against the statute. So rather than picking a sheriff, we would file against the statute, saying that the statute is unconstitutional as it's written, and to enjoin all the sheriffs in the state of Georgia from enforcing an unconstitutional statute. That's what we would do. And I think the odds are probably better than 50-50. We'll have to do that.
And
the alternative was far worse.
The alternative
was that we would have had a dozen, 20, 30, 40, 50 counties as it spread across the state. And then we would have had a much higher mountain to climb because the court would have been hesitant to have stopped the existing status quo because it would be becoming grained in culture. If we had just gone under a rock and said, let's hope it doesn't get any worse, it would have been like the illustration I just gave about International Megan's Law. The advance notice had been required since the 2006 Adam Walsh Act was signed into law by President George W. Bush. And it wasn't until a decade later in 2016 when the passports were required to be marked that all of a sudden an issue was raised about the advance notice requirement, which, although it wasn't in the statute, it was in practice. So we would have the exact same situation that we had with International Megan's Law, with advance notice. We would have had 47 sheriffs in Georgia doing it, and the judge would have been looking at me and said, well, where were you all the years this has been happening? An injunction is largely designed to protect the status quo. The status quo at that time would have been one-third of Georgia's counties were doing this already. So we nipped it in the bud.
What about the strategy of just waiting, saying, hey, let's lay our heads down and hope it doesn't get better?
Well,
how has that
worked out for you people?
I don't think it's worked out very well. That's my opinion, that if we just wait, it doesn't get better. There's not anybody else advocating to make this better.
You would have to be mentally challenged to think that ignoring it. If you look at the original registries and you look at the court decisions that explain how they have evolved and encroached, if ignoring that would have worked, the registration schemes wouldn't have evolved to the level that they have now, that they encroach on so many of your freedoms. Well, I think you can already see that ignoring things doesn't make it go away. I mean, you would have to be severely challenged to believe ignoring things makes in this particular thing, some things you do ignore, they go away. But ignoring encroachments into civil liberties, because they will never run out of creative things to try to encroach on your liberties when you're in a hated, despised group of the population. So therefore, keep ignoring it and tell me how that works out for you, because it hasn't worked out very well for you over the last 20 years.
All right, man. Hey, can somebody kick that soapbox out from underneath you?
Tutu, call us. I need some phone calls this week. So,
tell me what the website is, Larry. We can get out of here.
I don't care about the website. I want a phone call. Seven four seven two two seven four four seven seven.
And then support us on Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters. And with that, Larry, I will bid you a good night. We're at an hour and 49 minutes, so we can let it go.
All right. All right.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks for everybody hanging out in chat. And we'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Good night.